queens, welcome to Dose of Deception with the Queens of Queens, Shannon and Emily.
Join our true crime family where we discuss murders, missing persons cases, mysteries, and a whole lot of conspiracy theories. So stay tuned for the wild ride.
Hey queens, welcome back to Dose of Deception. Before we get into this episode, if you're a new listener, we just want to let you know what we do on this show. In the first half, Emily comes in with a true crime case, whether it be a missing person or a murder mystery. And then in the second half, I come in with a conspiracy theory that we discuss. This is once again going to be a two-part episode, so make sure you listen to this week and then tune in for next week for the continuation. And before we get into the topics today, we just want to let you know where you can find us on social media. Our Instagram is at Dose of Deception, and our Facebook group where we like to engage with our listeners is also at Dose of Deception. So, Emily, what are we starting with this week?
So today we're going to be talking about a serial killer. Because I feel like we haven't done many of those. Only Eileen, I'm pretty sure, is the only serial killer we
did. This season, yeah. I think you're right.
Even last season, no?
Yeah, I think you might be right. So this should be a good one.
So today we'll be covering the life of David Berkowitz, better known by the self-proclaimed title, Son of Sam, and labeled a .44 caliber killer by the media. We will also have a guest speaker to talk about what it was like to live in New York City and to be around just the five boroughs during the time that David Berkowitz wreaked havoc. So stay tuned for that. David Berkowitz was born Richard David Falco on June 1st, 1953 in Brooklyn. He was born to a Jewish woman named Betty, who, prior to having David, was in a four-year marriage with a man named Tony Falco, and he actually had left her for another woman after they had been married for 4 years. Mm-hmm. So in 1950, Betty began a relationship with a married man named Joseph Kleinman, and this is when she became pregnant with David. She decided to give him the last name Falco because it was still the name of her husband who had left her, and also because Joseph did not want his name associated with her baby. Mm-hmm. After only a few short days of giving birth to David, Betty gave him away because Joseph Kleinman threatened to leave her if she had kept the baby, and she essentially chose, you know, a man over her kid. Mm. So he was put up for adoption.
Dang.
Luckily, unlike most serial killers we have discussed who have no hope from the time they are born, like they're just born into really, really bad situations.
Yeah.
David was actually adopted by a middle-aged Jewish American couple named Pearl and Nathan Berkowitz from the Bronx, who really wanted to have a child and were not able to do so in their youth. And they loved him. They gave him a fresh start in life. They gave him the last name. They actually switched up his middle name too to make it David Richard Berkowitz.
Okay.
So they removed Falco from his name and kind of gave him a fresh start.
That's good.
So from a very young age, David's intelligence stood out from the rest. He was extremely smart, however, he was not interested in school, and instead he was attracted to petty crime, and he actually began starting fires. Mm. That was kind of where he started at.
I don't know, this seems to be a pattern whenever you talk about killers like that. It seems like in their youth that was something that kids like that did.
Definitely. I feel like it always starts with arsons, like fires, and animal abuse.
Yes.
Yeah.
It does seem to just be like a pattern that I've noticed when like looking at stuff like that.
Definitely. And those who grew up around him actually said that he had a spoiled, bratty personality.
Mm.
In terms of school, he was not popular and he had no friends. He was quiet and nobody really talked to him. When he was just 14 years old, David's mother, so his adopted mother, died from breast cancer, and he became more withdrawn. So this was at 14 years old, at such a vulnerable age where it could completely destroy your social connections, especially 14 years old, that's like high school, going into high school.
Yeah.
So I understand why David, after his mother passed away, why he'd become more withdrawn.
Yeah.
Luckily, he did continue on to complete high school, all while living in the Bronx apartment with his adoptive father.
Mm-hmm.
However, his life turned upside down when his adoptive father remarried, and it is extremely hard to wrap your head around this, especially during teenage years. So David, you know, he loved his mom, and then she passes away, and his father remarries, so he kind of had a lot of resentment in him in terms of that.
Okay.
Which makes sense.
And then does that make his relationship with his father shaky at that point?
Yeah, I mean, he actually still talks to his dad. I watched a lot of interviews with him in prison now.
Okay.
He's like a whole different person now. I'll get into that later.
Okay.
But he is still close with his father.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at the time it definitely strained the relationship.
Okay.
In 1971, when David was just 17 years old, he joined the army. 3 years later, in June 1974, he was honorably discharged, and I couldn't find much about that.
Okay.
But he was discharged from the army.
Yeah, I do think a lot of that information stays confidential, though.
Yeah. After this, he set out to reconnect with his birth mom, Betty, because he said that it kind of always got to him why she gave him up so easily.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he didn't really know anything about his birth parents.
Yeah, that makes sense. I feel like most adoptive kids at some point look into that stuff.
Definitely. And I think there was a lot of built-up stress regarding his adoption. Mm-hmm. So talking with Betty from a psychological standpoint, it would have been a good thing. However, for him and for people like him, mm-hmm. it was a completely traumatic experience that kind of shattered his identity because mm-hmm. he no longer knew who he was, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It is known that David was visibly upset by how many deadbeat potential dads he had in his life.
Mm.
Yeah. And it is believed that reconnecting with Betty was the initial incident that set David off on his killing spree.
Mm.
So David actually tried to lead a normal life after this encounter.
Okay.
And after he got discharged from the army. And he says even, because he did complete college as well.
Okay.
Yeah, and he says in interviews from later on in his life that he really had every intention when he was 22 years old is when he started these murders.
Yeah.
He really had every intention on just making a good life for himself, yeah. getting, you know, good connections around him, maybe starting a relationship.
Yeah.
And something switched.
I didn't even realize how young he would have been when this stuff was happening.
It's
because I only know the basic stories and, like, the actual murder story itself that, like, most people know. So I didn't look too much into him himself.
Mm-hmm.
So I always imagined him as somebody older.
I did too, but he was just our age, which is insane.
Which is crazy.
It's scary because he, like I said, he was just had his normal life and then something switched. And it's terrifying.
And like, sure, he had a lot of issues like when he was younger, but it's, you can't compare that to like Eileen's story, you know what I mean? So he had rough stuff happen to him, but it wasn't traumatizing to the point of a lot of the other people.
Definitely.
So it's interesting that it's just like, seems like something switched and not, like, it seemed obvious that something like this was going to happen as life was going on.
Yeah, it's really scary to think about. So, he did actually attend Bronx Community College for a year starting in 1975, and then he began working as a taxi driver in 1976. And he actually held a few jobs before he was arrested for the murders, which is interesting to me because I noticed with a lot of these serial killers, they don't have any sense of normalcy or any kind of job where they have, you know, financial security or where they just have, like, a routine, I guess. And that kind of is what leads them and, like, prevents them from, like, staying at bay.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that he did have this normal life outside of, like, his home life.
Yeah.
So now that you have a feel for David's background, let's get into the murders. His crime spree officially began December 1975 and did not end until he was captured on August 10th, 1977.
Mm.
So this was almost a 2-year-long reign of terror throughout the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Queens, which made even the toughest New Yorkers scared to leave their homes. David's first attack was the Foreman stabbing, which occurred on Christmas Eve, 1975, when David was just 22 years old. He used a hunting knife to stab two young women on a bridge in the Bronx. Luckily, one of the women ran away, but David did stab 15-year-old Michelle Foreman, and she actually survived her attack. So this isn't the first murder, this is just when he started with his crime spree.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she was hospitalized for 7 days because her wounds were very severe, but she did survive.
That's good.
And understandably, she could not recall any solid details about her attacker.
Yeah.
And since David had no connection to either of the girls, he was not a suspect, and authorities did not know he really existed yet.
Yeah.
He quickly left the Bronx, and he began renting an apartment in Yonkers, where he would live for the remainder of his murders. He actually lived at 35 Pine Street. However, they did change the address afterwards so that it wouldn't be associated with him.
Yeah, makes sense.
But yeah, you can see it online. You can go to it. It's just like a normal apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
So 7 months went by before David's next crime occurred on July 29th, 1976 at 1:10 a.m. His next two victims were Donna Loria and Jody Valenti, who he shot in the Pelham Bay area of the Bronx. His method of killing changed from stabbing to shooting, most likely because shooting can occur from further away, and it's not as personal as stabbing, making it more difficult for the victims to see his face in case they survived, like Michelle Foreman before.
Makes sense.
So 18-year-old Donna and 19-year-old Jody were sitting in a car discussing the fun night they had just had at the nightclub called Peachtrees in New Rochelle, when a man they did not recognize, later coined the Son of Sam, pulled a pistol from a brown paper bag and shot Donna one time, which instantly killed her, and he also struck Jody, but only in her thigh, ultimately allowing her to get away as he fled the scene soon after.
He's, like, a very messy killer.
I know.
Like, he doesn't have any kind of plan whatsoever.
No, and also, we'll get into how many people actually survived the attacks.
Yeah.
He is a very messy killer. And he was talking in prison as well about this particular murder,
mm-hmm.
and how he shot her in the thigh, and he was planning on going after her to finish the job, but he didn't want to spend any more time at the scene in case cops came, so he just let her get away, knowing that she could have easily seen his face and gave a description. So it's crazy to me that it took so long for him to get caught because of how messy he was.
Yeah.
Jody could only give a basic description of the man, like him being white and having dark curly hair,
mm-hmm.
but this did not help authorities much, as she could not give a detailed description.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Jody's father, as well as some other neighbors, claimed to have seen a man with dark curly hair sitting in a yellow car and kind of driving around the area a few hours before the shooting. Mm. So just remember the yellow car for future references as I explain the other murders as well. The next murders occurred on October 23rd, 1976, in Forest Hills Gardens, Queens.
Very close.
Very close by.
Very close to the Queens of Queens. Mm-hmm.
Despite living in Yonkers, that's kind of also a side note why I like this case, because it's like in New York and it's very representative of our show.
Yes, absolutely. And like, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of more places that you stay than when we're like, wow.
Yeah, definitely.
That's literally 10 minutes away.
So despite living in Yonkers, David did seem to choose victims mainly in Queens. So going forward, most of the murders I discuss will be here. Mm. Also, since we are from New York City, we can vouch that this area is extremely nice. Honestly, I feel so safe walking there.
Yes. That whole area is just, especially the part that's just the house.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just, it almost feels like a gated community without it being a gated, because you can drive through it, but it feels like a gated community.
It also feels like the suburbs. It doesn't feel like the city.
100%. And it's all mansions. Mm-hmm. Like, it's huge houses there. So it's a lot of well-off people that live there. So it's not a place that you would imagine something like this happening.
Yes. And like I said, I feel very safe walking there anytime, really. So the fact that gruesome murders were occurring in places that nobody expected and that they were occurring across multiple boroughs made the Son of Sam's terror even more horrifying for New York City residents.
Yeah, because you would never know where he would come up, basically.
Exactly. So 20-year-old Carl De Niro and 18-year-old Rosemary Keenan, who actually attended Queens College, were in Rosemary's car when a bullet came flying through the window, shattering it. Rosemary immediately sped away, and both parties thought they were safe. However, due to the adrenaline rush and shock, Carl did not even realize at first that he had been shot in the head. Yeah. Luckily, he survived his injuries, but he did have to get a portion of his skull replaced. Mm. So he was hurt, but he survived somehow. Like, so many people in this case just survived. I don't get it. Despite both people coming out of this encounter alive, neither saw the perpetrator. This was very similar setting to the previous murders, and I mentioned earlier that David most likely had the intention to kill women. Mm-hmm. Or actually, I don't think I mentioned that yet, but we will get into it a little bit later when we talk about the psychology behind it. And Carl De Niro actually had long, dark hair, which fits the profile of the previous victims. And since David didn't see his face straight on, authorities believe that he mistook him for a woman.
Yeah, might have just seen the hair.
Definitely.
At this point in the case, have the police pieced together, like, this is all probably the same person or no?
Not yet.
Okay.
They started to kind of get suspicions after the first few, but it was mainly, I'd say, obviously, once he wrote his first letter.
Yes.
They were like, wow, we have a serial killer on our hands.
Okay.
Despite having no clues as to who this perpetrator was, authorities did note that the .44 caliber pistol was used to shoot this as well. And so this was kind of around the time that they started suspecting that it might have been maybe the same person.
Okay.
And that's eventually how he earned his name, the .44 caliber killer.
Okay.
David's next victims were very young. 16-year-old Donna DeMasi and 18-year-old Joanne Lomino. I'm sorry in advance if I'm pronouncing the last names wrong. I'm trying my best here.
Yes, they're all very Italian last names. The accent tends to come out more when it's something Italian like that.
Like the New York accent?
Yes. Yeah. So if we are checking to make sure that we say things correctly, but if the pronunciation of it is slightly off, that's why.
So these two girls were out late one night as they walked home from a movie theater. It was actually after midnight, a little bit after midnight, on November 27th, 1976. As they were discussing the movie on Joanne's stoop at her home in Floral Park, a man dressed in a military outfit approached them, pretended like he was asking for directions, and then he pulled out a pistol. Both girls were shot, and luckily, both survived.
Whoa!
Yeah, this is, like, crazy.
But this is probably good, because this is probably the clearest...
The clearest sight they had of him.
Yeah.
However, Joanne was shot in her back, and unfortunately, the shots paralyzed her, and she was only 18 years old. Dang. So, honestly, that's so sad.
Yeah.
2 months go by without another murder from the Son of Sam, when on January 30th, 1977, more terrifying shots were heard around 12:40 a.m. Christine Freund was a 26-year-old secretary who was engaged with John Deal, a 30-year-old bartender. They, too, were sitting in a parked car near the LIRR station in Forest Hills.
Crazy, because of how many times I have gotten the train at that stop before.
They had actually just gotten back from seeing Rocky, which just came out then.
Mm.
They were in the car talking about the movie when two gunshots coming from a .44 caliber pistol hit Christine and another bullet hit John. John drove away as fast as he could despite being shot, but unfortunately Christine died a few hours later in the hospital. Mm. And, of course, like most of the other ones, neither had seen David's face, so authorities are back to square one.
I don't know if this is better for him or Not, because he's always doing it from so far away, which keeps not killing the people, which obviously in hindsight is good, but for him would not be good. But it's still also letting them not see him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I don't know if this is what his plan was to do that, or if he was genuinely trying to kill them and just wanted to make sure he didn't get caught for it.
I think he was genuinely trying to kill them initially, because he started out with stabbing, remember?
Yes.
But once she survived, he realized that he probably wouldn't be able to kill many people with just stabbing.
Yes.
So that's why he switched to shooting. So I guess it was kind of a trade-off, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Now, on March 8th, 1977, at only 7:30 p.m., so it's interesting because it's much earlier than the ones that he was doing after midnight. And also, I feel like he was just doing this so out in the open, because 7:30 is early. I feel like people would still be walking around.
100% people would still be.
It's like he didn't even try to hide, but somehow he managed.
He still got away with it.
Yeah, he managed to get away with it for so long. So on March 8th, 1977, at 7:30 p.m., a 19-year-old girl named Virginia was confronted by David Berkowitz on her walk home from university. He pulled out his gun and shot her, and in a desperate attempt to protect herself, Virginia actually held up one of her textbooks in hopes that it would be thick enough to stop the bullet or at least protect her face.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it went right through the textbook and hit her head, killing her instantly. On April 17th, 1977, at 3 a.m., 20-year-old Alexander and 18-year-old Valentina Suriani were sitting in her car in the Bronx when each of them was shot twice.
Mm.
Valentina died before making it to the hospital, and despite Alexander living for a few hours longer, he could not offer authorities any useful information regarding the shooter.
Yeah.
Interestingly, this was the first of the murders in which the shooter left a note behind for authorities to see.
Mm.
And in his first letter, he coined the name Son of Sam.
Mm.
So this is a pretty long letter. I'm just going to read parts of it because it is very long. He says, "I am deeply hurt by your calling me a women hater." He spelt women wrong.
Okay.
"I am not, but I am a monster. I am the Son of Sam. I am a little brat. When Father Sam gets drunk, he gets mean. He beats his family. Sometimes he ties me up to the back of the house. Other times he locks me in the garage. Sam loves to drink blood. Go out and kill, commands Father Sam. Behind our house, some rest. Mostly young. Raped and slaughtered, their blood drained. Just bones now. Papa Sam keeps me locked in the attic, too. I can't get out, but I look out the attic window and watch the world go by. I feel like an outsider. I am on a different wavelength than everybody else, programmed to kill. However, to stop me, you must kill me. Attention, all police. Shoot me first. Shoot to kill or else. Keep out of my way or you will die. Papa Sam is old now. He needs some blood to preserve his youth." And then it goes on and on, but he ends it with, "I want to make love to the world. I love people. I don't belong on Earth. Return me to Yahoos, to the people of Queens. I love you. And I want to wish you all a happy Easter. May God bless you in this life and in the next. And for now, I say goodbye and goodnight. Police, let me haunt you with these words. I'll be back. I'll be back." And then he signed it, "Yours in murder, Mr. Monster."
This is so odd to me because the only situation, at least obviously his real father and the person that his mom left him for, he has animosity to. But his adoptive father seems like he was a fine guy.
Yeah.
So it's weird to me that he's, like, made up this persona that it's revolving around him.
Yeah, but no, this isn't actually... So Sam, who he's talking about, isn't his...
No, yeah, I know, but I'm just saying it's weird that this is the persona that he created and didn't create something weird, because if I was the police and I read this letter, I would assume that the suspect is someone that had some kind of ill relationship with his father or something happened with his father. So it's odd that this is the character that he's created, and it doesn't really seem to have any relation to his own personal life.
I agree. And also, we'll get into a little bit later, but the Son of Sam who he's referring to is actually one of his neighbors named Sam Carr, who had a dog at the time, a Labrador. Mm. And, I mean, I'll get into it a little bit later, but that's who he's referencing in this, which is so random.
It's so weird.
Yeah. Interestingly, because many of the letters in this word are misspelled, including women, as I mentioned before, it's like kind of surprising because I mentioned earlier he was very intelligent growing up, so it's odd to see him write this way, like with such terrible grammar. And also in prison interviews today that I've watched with David, he speaks so eloquently, and so he says words like I just don't even know, like he speaks very proper, he's very educated sounding, and he also doesn't know why he called himself Son of Sam, and he also says today he does not want to be associated at all with that name.
It does seem like at this point it was just either to divert attention away from himself strategy, or just that he wanted to be entertained by this and he found this amusing.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it had any real meaning behind it.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I can tell you, it was frightening. The first couple of incidents that happened, they didn't put it together right away that it was him. So you just figured out it's just, you know, unfortunately a murder or whatever. But after a while, when they started piecing it together and you got this idea that it was a serial killer, it was frightening because, especially for me, because I happened to be the age group that he was hitting up. So wherever you went, if you went to the deli, if you went to the club, if you went to the place, you didn't know if it was him. So there was all kinds of crazy stories going around, like, wait a minute, there's the son of Sam. He's over there. He's over, you know, yeah. So it was a very frightening, and it kind of felt like the police had no idea where he was, so it felt like they were never going to catch him.
So on May 30th, 1977, about a month after this letter, another letter was written, and it was sent to Jimmy Breslin, who, at the time, was a profound columnist for Daily News.
Mm, makes sense.
The letter was once again handwritten, and it was much longer than the first, so I'm just going to say a few key points or interesting details that I found. On the back of the letter, it said, "Blood and family, darkness and death, absolute depravity, 44, like 44 caliber killer kind of. In the letter, the writer explains how they read Jimmy Breslin's articles daily, and they appreciate the interest he has taken with the 44 caliber killings. It writes, "Tell me, Jim, what will you have for July 29th? And that's interesting because July 29th would be the one-year anniversary of the first shooting. And the writer indicates their excitement about the column that will be written about it. He also says, quote, "You can forget about me if you like, because I don't care for publicity. However, you must not forget Donna Loria, and you cannot let people forget her either. She was a very, very sweet girl, but Sam's a thirsty lad, and he won't let me stop killing until he gets his fill of blood. Remember Miss Loria. Thank you. In their blood and from the gutter, Sam's creation."
So weird.
It is weird.
I don't...
It's also weird that he picked out that one victim.
Exactly, yes. That is weird. Because, again, if I was the police, that would make me think that she wasn't a random killing, that there was some kind of connection.
True.
And none of this is true, so it seems like it's just strategy to confuse the police.
It's also random because it's not like he talked to any of the victims.
No.
Like he liked her the best or anything.
Yeah.
The writer ends the letter with, "P.S. JB, please inform all the detectives working the case that I wish them the best of luck. Keep them digging, drive on, think positive, get off your butts, knock on coffins, etc. Upon my capture, I promise to buy all the guys working the case a new pair of shoes if I can get up the money. Son of Sam."
I'm curious to think how long he thought he was going to be able to get away with this.
Yeah.
Because the way he's talking, it seems like he's thinks that he's above the law and they're never going to catch him and all this stuff. So he seems like he's a little too confident right now with what's going on.
But it's crazy because, as we said earlier, his actions are just kind of reckless. It's not really... It's not like he's trying to hide or anything, so it's weird that he would have this kind of mentality.
And he's so centered on one location. At this point, obviously there was shootings and killings outside of Queens, but at this point he's already said he loves the people of Queens. Like, this is where he's going to be.
He did say Queens has the most beautiful women.
I mean, he's not wrong. But he's so centered on this one place, which is going to make it easier to try to find him.
Yeah.
I know he doesn't live there, but still, he's going to be there a lot at that point. And he's leaving letters. Was there any, like, DNA or anything on any of these letters at
Nothing
any point?
Substantial they could find.
Yeah, so he's a little too cocky for somebody that is going to get caught any day now.
Yeah.
So in that moment in time, as soon as you got up in the morning, you'd head to the deli or you'd get the news or the Post delivered, and you'd see the paper. That's the way it was at that point. But when that hysteria was going on, especially that stretch where he was writing the letters to the police and, you know, "I am the son of Sam," all the stuff, you just kept seeing that on any place you went. If you went in a deli, you saw the newspaper with his face on, or you saw the letter. So I know what you're saying. As far as it affecting it differently now, I think it would have been even more hysterical now. Because, you know, you're going to get up in the morning and everybody's on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, and probably everybody in town would be him, you know. Yeah. I don't know, but I if I had to make a guess, the media is so much more powerful today, and so much more to it. I would have to believe it would be even more hysterical, to the point that there might be people that actually wouldn't even come out of the house. Because they did make it sound like wherever you went, he was there. Which is impossible, but you didn't know, you know. The thing is, it was the age group he was hitting that really made me, like, you know, it's most of the victims were in their 20s, right? And so that's how old I was, you know. So that age group, you know, and that era, they were, you know, you had that nightlife situation, they were all going at this, you know, you're talking the 70s and, you know, everything, Saturday Night Fever and all this disco. And so, like, it that kind of idea that everybody was going out at night, or even when you went to the movies, they had you so frightened that he was standing in the parking lot, or even when he was just walking on the street shooting. So I think the media would have made it even more so, my own opinion.
The shootings did not stop here. On June 26, 1977, at 3 a.m., 20-year-old Sal Lupo and 17-year-old Judy Placido were sitting in his car in Bayside, Queens.
It's getting closer and closer.
It is. The creepiest part is that the couple had been talking about the Son of Sam. Mm. Right at the time when three bullets shot through the window of their car. Mm. Sal was only hit in the forearm, so he was able to drive away.
Okay.
And Judy was hit in the neck and the temple, but she somehow survived.
Wow.
Both victims did not see the shooter, but they did see a man running away and could only remember that he had dark hair.
Okay.
But they were also able to give authorities a partial license plate number, which is more than any of the other victims were able to see.
Was it the same yellow car?
Yes.
Mm. Okay.
Which they didn't find him with this, but they find him later on.
Okay.
And it all goes back to his yellow car.
And so this is the most information they've gotten so far.
Definitely. The final shooting, and the one that most people think of when you say Son of Sam, is that of Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violante. Police were on high alert because the one-year anniversary of the first shooting was approaching. Mm. So they had officers stationed throughout Queens, assuming that he would strike again.
Yeah.
This time, however, David went to Brooklyn to perform his final murder.
Okay.
Throw him off a little,
makes
you know?
Sense.
On July 31st, 1977, 20-year-old Stacy and Robert were in his car, parked in Bath Beach, Brooklyn. Robert asked Stacy if she wanted to get out and go for a walk in the park, to which she replied, "What if the Son of Sam is out there?"
I can't. This guy
it's
just
crazy.
Magically appears whenever his name's called at this point.
Literally. Still, they got out, they sat on swings, and they kissed. It was also their first date, I forgot to say.
Aww.
That. It's so sad. When they saw a man run into some nearby bushes, and they got spooked. So they were on the swings, and they saw this weird dude, and they were like, let's go back to the car.
Yeah.
And Robert did survive, so to this day, he actually talks in interviews about how sweet Stacy was and how he was so excited and nervous for their first date.
This is so sad.
It is really sad. He actually says that before leaving for the date, his mother told them to be careful for the Son of Sam, and they joked about it because it never seems like it could happen to you.
Yeah.
Since they were spooked on the swings, they walked back to their car, and they were kissing in his car when four shots were fired into the vehicle, striking both victims in the head.
Mm.
Robert discusses in interviews how he was just starting his life out, and he had actually signed a contract to a modeling agency because he was only 20 years old. However, the bullet went through his left eye. He lost his eye, and it blinded him in his other eye. So you can tell, even to this day, he's older now.
Yeah.
But he, like, obviously he lost his modeling contract after that.
Dang.
So it kind of ruined, you know, whatever he wanted to do in life.
Yeah.
And also, Stacy was hit in the head as well, but she wasn't as lucky to survive. She actually died from the shots.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, police noted that Stacy was the first blonde victim, and the rest had long, dark hair.
Mm.
So that's interesting to note.
Mm-hmm.
So David clearly had a preference for female victims, specifically ones with long, dark hair. And it got so bad that my mom's actually said this. She said that people in her family were doing this, that people began cutting their hair super short and dyeing it blonde.
Yeah.
So that he wouldn't kill them,
pretty
much. That
makes sense. That's crazy that you have to go to that length because you just never know.
Yeah.
That's insane.
And some people think this may stem from his resentment for his mother for giving him up.
Mm.
And he killed people who may have resembled her.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in a prison interview from 1998, David denies this, and he does not believe that his mom had anything to do with choice of victims. But from a psychological standpoint, which we assume that all aggression and behaviors are childhood traumas that come to adulthood, it does make sense in that case. Because I know the adoption really messed with him.
Yeah, and this makes me so much more fascinated to know the details of their meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Because that seems to be the event that triggered all of this, so it makes me so interested to know what really happened during that.
Definitely. David also sought out couples. Specifically heterosexual couples. So psychologists believe that this stems from his lack of social connections during his youth, which prevented him from forming healthy, stable, desirable relationships, and even a romantic relationship with a woman.
That makes sense.
It is also believed that David got sexual gratification out of his crimes. In terms of serial killers, men and women are very different in terms of why they commit murder.
Mm-hmm.
Women kill generally for financial reasons or power, and rarely have sexual motives behind it. Almost always, a male killer seems to get off on the kills, which doesn't make sense to me, but
disgusting.
It is absolutely disgusting. So although he did not do anything sexual to the victims or even touch them, the fact that he would actually return to the crime scenes to relive them, in a sense, is indicative of this idea that maybe he did get sexual gratification from it.
Yeah.
So we're going to end the episode this week with the murders, but next week we will tell you about the capture and arrest of David Berkowitz and his legacy that still lives on.
Hey Queens, welcome back to the conspiracy half of this episode. Just a reminder, just like the first half, my half is also going to be a two-parter. So make sure you listen into this half and then come back next week so you can hear the end of our theories.
Definitely.
So in this week and next week's episode, we will be talking about what I can say confidently is America's most popular conspiracy theory, without a doubt. We will be talking about the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the events surrounding his death.
I love this conspiracy theory.
So do I.
There's so much depth to it.
So much. When I was looking into it, it has literally made me fascinated to the point of the books that I've, like, read excerpts on and the articles that I've seen. Like, I want to read these books. Yeah. I want to do all this stuff. Because this is a theory that I've heard a lot about, and it's just so complicated, and so many people believe different theories that it's interesting to me to figure out which one I believe.
Definitely. Also, yeah, same. Like, I'll hear a bunch of different theories and they all make sense to me, but 100%. There's just so many of them that it can't be everything. So it's crazy.
At some point, literally everybody could have been blamed as part of this conspiracy. Or some people just think that there's no conspiracy involved at all, which, spoiler alert, I do think that there's some kind of conspiracy going on.
Yeah, me too.
I will save for down the road which one I think has the strongest weight behind it, but I 100% think that there's some kind of conspiracy involved with it. Now, like most other theories that revolve around real-life events, I'm going to first lay out the course of events in the historically accepted way before diving into the theories about who was behind the events and if they derive from how most people accept them to have happened.
Okay.
Now, also, this first half is going to be a lot of, it's going to seem like little tiny details, but these little details, like a random person's name or where they happen to be, ultimately, when you speak about the theories, those little details become very important. Okay. So if it might seem like minute points that I'm making, it comes back to be important. So also, credit where it's due, most of the information about the actual timeline of Kennedy's assassination is coming from JFK Library's website itself. So it's important to keep in mind the political atmosphere at the time. Although it had not been confirmed at the time, it was well known that Kennedy had every intention of running for re-election the following year. Therefore, his traveling around to city and states at the time was just as much for campaigning as it was for presidential duties and speeches. Although his overall approval rating by 1963 had slipped from when he was first in office, leaving his re-election not a guarantee at that point, he did still hold a majority approval rating, and to this day, his average approval rating is the highest amongst all presidents since Truman, or basically anyone after the World War II era. So, even though, yes, his approval rating by the time of his assassination had been quote-unquote lower, it's still much higher than the average president's. Now, it's also important to note the United States' relationship with the USSR at this point. After promising diplomatic solutions rather than violence during his original presidential campaign, JFK had disastrous and violent results following the Bay of Pigs invasions, which he was critiqued heavily for this event. And this we will circle back to when we speak about the USSR later on again. However, diplomacy had much better effects as time went on for JFK, as by the time of his death, Kennedy had created a short-term solution regarding missile development with the USSR, and was for the most part commended for his reactions to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now I'm going to get into the actual events surrounding his death. For hopes of his re-election to be a success, Kennedy desperately needed to win re-election in the states of Florida and Texas. Therefore, on November 21st, 1963, Kennedy, his wife Jacqueline Kennedy, Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson, and other political advisors to Kennedy and other leaders of the Democratic Party embarked on a two-day, five-city trip throughout Texas. The political climate in Texas was tense at the time, as the Democratic Party throughout the state was divided. Also, in the weeks prior to Kennedy's trip, right-leaning extremists had attacked Ambassador to the United Nations and well-known liberal Adlai Stevenson in Dallas, as the city seemed to be a hub for a lot of anti-Kennedy people. Despite this, the first day of the trip was widely viewed as a success, as Kennedy visited the Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio, continued to Houston to speak in front of the League of Latin American Citizens, and attended a dedication dinner for a Congress member. He then traveled to Fort Worth, Texas, and stayed there for his first night. The following morning, November 22nd, he was greeted warmly by supporters outside of the hotel that he was staying at. After saying a few remarks, he left for a breakfast at the Fort Worth Chamber of Commerce and then began traveling to Dallas. They drove to the airport and took a 13-minute flight over to Dallas. Upon arrival, they stopped to greet supporters waiting for them at the airport. They then got in a convertible car, which was basically just a limousine. And at this point, it had been inclement weather in the beginning of the day. By that point, the rain had stopped, so they decided to leave the roof off of the car, which we can see where that's going. So this car would be taking the Kennedys, Texas Governor John Connally, and his wife Nellie to the Trade Mart in Dallas, where Kennedy was scheduled to deliver a speech there. They were being driven by Secret Service agent William Robert Greer, who, again, comes up in the conspiracy theories later on.
Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't there, like, security around him, but I realized...
Yes. So, The Secret Service agent was the driver, and the Johnsons were in a car behind the one with the president and the first lady and the governor's first lady. So, there was also Secret Service members in the car with the Johnsons, and they were surrounded, basically, with Secret Service agents.
Okay.
Also, the route was predetermined that they were going to be taking, so there was security scattered and police, heavy police presence throughout the route that they were going to be taking because they knew exactly the route that they were going to be going. So, the route that the car was driving was 10 miles long and had an estimated 200,000 people along it to see the presidents drive by.
Damn, that's a lot.
A lot of people. Which, of course, creates a complete chaos after the events that happened because of just how many people are there.
Mm-hmm.
At about 12:30, the motorcade that contained the president turned off Main Street southwest onto Elm Street through Dealey Plaza, passing the Texas School Book Depository while doing this. Now, forewarning, this is the part where I'm describing the actual assassination, so if that is something that is bothersome to you, just be warned from here. At 12:30, according to reports, a total of 3 gunshots were fired.
At what time?
12:30.
Okay.
One bullet hit Kennedy through his neck and exited through his throat. This same bullet then hit the governor's shoulder, went through his chest and wrist, and ultimately ended up hitting his thigh. Which, again, keep in mind the trajectory of this bullet for later theories. A second bullet, which reports have been inconclusive whether this was the second or third shot fired total, as the second and third shot were shot in immediate succession of one another. This hit Kennedy in his head. I won't get into very graphic details of this, but Jackie Kennedy was reported saying, "They have killed my husband, I have his brains in my hand," and parts of him ended up scattered and in different cars. So, Kennedy was immediately rushed to nearby Parkland Memorial Hospital. However, at that point, nothing really could be done, and by 1 p.m., Kennedy was pronounced dead at the hospital. Governor Connally was seriously wounded, however, he did ultimately survive. His wife is actually credited greatly with helping him survive, as after he was shot, Nellie pulled him into her lap, and that posture that he had helped air get into his chest his right lung had collapsed.
Oh, wow.
So without knowing, she really is credited, basically, with keeping him alive for as long as he was.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. So a bystander named James Tague was also wounded as a fractured part of the second bullet hit his cheek. Now, at first, when James was being questioned, he wasn't sure whether it was the second or third bullet, but he, after being pressured, said the second bullet. So that has led some people to believe that maybe that is the one that hit Kennedy, but again, it was after he was pressured to question it, so it's still pretty inconclusive on which shot is really the one that hit him. Now, Kennedy's body was brought back to the airport and placed on Air Force One. Before taking off, Johnson was sworn in by U.S. District Court Judge Sarah Hughes, and Johnson became president at 2:38 p.m. So this really all happens within the course of 2-3 hours. Now, after the shots were fired, a man named Howard Brennan approached police to inform them that while standing across the street from the Texas School Book Depository, he heard that the first shot fired fuzzed from above him. After turning to look, he claimed to notice a man in the window of the 6th floor holding a rifle. After this report from Brennan, he informed the police, and the police released the information that Brennan was able to give them. After this, employees at the Texas School Book Depository that were working on the fifth floor claimed to have heard gunshots come from directly above their heads. At the scene, 104 witnesses that police spoke to were asked about what direction they heard the gunshots come from. Over 50% claimed to have heard them directly from the building, while 31% heard the shot come from grassy knolls, which those also become important later on.
Okay.
And an overpass in the same direction as the building.
Okay.
So most people, at least, even if they didn't hear it directly from the building,
they had the same direction.
Yeah.
Okay.
So employee Buell Wesley Frazier stated to police that he saw Lee Harvey Oswald arrive to work that day with a large brown paper bag. When Frazier questioned Oswald about the contents of the bag, Oswald said that they were curtain rods, which, why do you have curtain rods at work? After he was reported missing from work, police identified him as a suspect and publicly released his information.
Are you going to explain more, like, who he was?
Yes, okay. We'll be getting into
his information. Because I do obviously know about him, but I don't know his background or anything.
That comes into more of when we talk about the conspiracy theories, because it especially becomes important when you look at the USSR connections to the theories. Now, every other employee at the building had been accounted for besides Oswald at this point, so it became pretty clear very early that he was the main suspect. Now, police officer J.D. Tippett saw Oswald walking about 3 miles away from the location of the shooting. After asking Oswald to stand by the car, Oswald shot and killed Tippett with 4 bullets.
Damn.
Oswald then fled. He was then seen by a store manager fleeing into a store before sneaking into the Texas Theater. After a ticket clerk called the police at 1:40, officers were able to apprehend him after Oswald tried to reach for his pistol. Now, at this point, if you think about it, Kennedy was shot at 12:30. By 1:40, they already had Oswald in custody.
Damn, that's a lot. That's crazy.
Yeah, they acted very, very quickly, and things were lucky enough to be able to be pieced together very early. So by that night, Oswald was charged with killing Kennedy and Tippett. He claimed his innocence and that he was simply being accused due to having lived in the USSR and for having ties to communism. He even asked to be represented in court by John Apt, who served as the attorney for the American Communist Party at the time. So he's making himself very suspicious at this point. Now, on the morning of November 21st, Oswald was being transported from Dallas City Hall to the county jail. This transfer was being broadcasted live throughout the country. Before even making it off the perimeter of City Hall, Jack Ruby, a local nightclub owner in Dallas, shot Oswald in the chest. Oswald was taken to Parkland Memorial, the same place Kennedy had died days earlier, when he was pronounced dead at 1:07 p.m. When questioned after he was detained, Ruby said that he was completely distraught over Kennedy's death, and he, quote, wanted to spare Mrs. Kennedy the discomfiture of coming back to trial.
Okay. Wait, what happened to this guy?
He was arrested in jail.
Okay, did he die?
He died only a short few years after this happened because he fell ill while he was in jail.
Okay.
So he was arrested. It wasn't like he was assassinated, but he didn't live much longer after he was arrested and after these events. Okay. So now I'm going to get into the theories surrounding the motivation behind his death. I obviously cannot get into every single conspiracy theory that there is.
There's so many.
It's insane.
It's overwhelming.
Yes. I read a quote from former Los Angeles District Attorney Vincent Bugliosi that at some point or another, 42 groups, 82 assassins, and 214 people had been accused at one time or another for Kennedy's assassination.
That's insane.
I mean, if we wanted to cover every single one, the entire podcast would just have to become about Kennedy's assassination.
I was going
to
say, it would just be a JFK podcast.
Absolutely. So, soon following Kennedy's death, Lyndon B. Johnson formed the President's Commission on the Assassination of President Kennedy. This became known as the Warren's Commission, named after Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the United States at the time. It is well known that Johnson himself believed that a conspiracy was behind Kennedy's death, and that is why he worked to form this commission in the first place. But he was afraid to openly say this to the public, as he did not want to create open chaos or sever already shaky ties with the USSR by throwing out accusations. It's also well known that the USSR did not like Johnson, and at that point, obviously ties when things were with Kennedy weren't the greatest, but they were definitely improving by the time of his death. And I really do think relations with the USSR would have been greatly different if Kennedy had survived. So he already was on bad terms with them, not worth throwing out accusations that they did something. After an investigation spanning 10 months that used eyewitness reports, FBI reports, several videos from the day of the events, the autopsy of Kennedy's body itself, and reenactments, an 888-page report was released. Like, can you imagine? That stated that Oswald, a former Marine, was capable of acting alone. There was no evidence that a larger conspiracy was at play regarding Kennedy's and Oswald's deaths.
Sounds like a cover-up.
Yes, which, yes. We will get into this commission a little bit because it's a little sketch. And it wasn't the greatest commission, even though 888 pages is a lot of investigation. There was a lot of things that didn't really go right with it. It is worth noting that there are countless inconsistencies, evidence tamperings, and overlooked testimonies that are surrounding Kennedy's death. I will get into each of these as they apply to each conspiracy. So, in 1979, the United States House Select Committee on Assassinations, which I didn't know that all these groups existed specifically for looking into this kind of stuff. Now, this was a group that also helped with looking into the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., so pretty credible.
Mm-hmm.
This group determined that although the Warren Commission was correct in identifying Oswald as the person that assassinated Kennedy, there was more than likely a second gunman and a high possibility that a conspiracy was involved.
Why do they think this?
Well, I'm going to get into a couple of the things first that speak about the possibility of a second gunman, and also because they disregarded in the Warren Commission a lot of testimonies that seem to be very credible, and they kind of used the evidence that helped their story.
Oh, that basically makes sense, yeah.
So the original FBI reports were seen as extremely flawed that were used in the Warren Commission. Now, the first detail that is questioned most often about Kennedy's death is the idea that Oswald could not have been acting alone. The belief that there was a second gunman helps support many of the theories that believe that outside sources were looking to kill Kennedy. Now, whether a second gunman was helping with the same assassination attempt as Oswald was is up for debate. It is quite possible and realistic that due to the anti-Kennedy sentiment that raged through Dallas at the time, which he really was not popular in Dallas at the time, that another person was also looking to kill Kennedy. There's also several pieces of evidence that support another gunman, the most famous of which being the Zapruder film. Now, this was one of the recordings taken during the shooting used in the initial investigation and is widely believed to be the most clear. It certainly is. The other films I was looking at that the police would have been using at the time, it's just this one is definitely the most obvious and shows the exact course of events the most clear. Now, when looking at the film frame by frame, which again, only watch if you are someone that you know can handle this sort of thing, especially if you watch the full one, it's not something that you want to see.
Yeah, no.
So when looking at the film frame by frame, you see JFK's head fly backwards upon impact of the second bullet. This makes many people question how the second shot can be coming from Oswald, as Oswald would have been shooting from behind Kennedy.
So it would have pushed him forward?
Yes. Now, the explanation that the police give, and just the FBI, anyone involved with it, give, is that the impact from the first bullet that hit him had made his body shoot forward, and then him going backwards was just the impact of him going back, like whiplashing back.
Yeah.
Which I guess does make sense, but then in my mind, you would have went back and then immediately went right back forward.
Because of the second bullet?
Yes. Yeah, so to me, the timing is odd because there was a gap of time between the first bullet and the second and third bullet are the ones that were shot right back to back from each other. Now, this frame that shows this, 313, was not shown in the original copy of the film that was released to the public. It is claimed that Zapruder was so traumatized by that part of the film that he was only willing to sell the rights to the film if that part was taken out.
Hmm.
Which, a little sus.
That is sus. We were just talking about it, how much, video evidence is supposed to be the most clear.
Yeah.
And the one that helps the most, but yes. I feel like so many times it's so tampered with.
Yes, realistically, it should be easily the most credible source because it's literally a recording of what happened. It shows you exactly what happened, but there's so many cases that we've come across even just from doing this show that evidence and cases start to go sideways because video's messed with. Now, it was not until 1975 when a talk show was able to get a hold of the original unedited film that the general public was able to see it. Now, so many people saw it at one shot because they just played this on the TV show, so there was already millions of people watching it, and then word spread quickly of it. Now, this led to the investigations after public outcry that resulted in the government admitting that the FBI and CIA did withhold information during the original investigation, during the original Warren Commission, which, weird. Now, people have also noted the awkward movement, like jerkiness, that people claim were unnatural and show evidence of the video being edited. Now, it is a shaky video, which to me doesn't necessarily mean it, when an event like that is happening, you're not going to be able to steady your hand like that. But some people say, and some people that would know more about photography and videos than I would, say that that movement is not the type of movement that would be happening. Also, former senior official at the CIA's National Photographic Interpretation Center, which again, crazy that that exists, Dino Brugioni, has said that he believes that the original video that he saw when going through the evidence in the days immediately following Kennedy's death is not the same that is available to the public now. So he claims that this is two different videos, that the one that he was looking at first is not the one used now. Now, another theory that a lot of people use that show that there was a second person involved beside Oswald is the Umbrella Man theory. Now, the Umbrella Man was one of the closest bystanders to Kennedy at the time that the shots were fired. Now, it was not raining when Kennedy was driving through, so at the time, there's no understandable reason for the umbrella to be open, because he was standing there just dressed in blood. It looks very ominous. It's very creepy if you don't know who it is. He's just standing there with his umbrella open, very casual-like. So people began to question if the umbrella was a covert weapon. The CIA has since confirmed that a weapon like this was in existence during the time of Kennedy's assassination. So something like this was readily available to CIA agents. So it would have been possible for someone to get their hands on this, whether that person be from the USSR, Cuba, America, we'll get into later. So some experts believe that a dart tranquilizer could have been shot from the umbrella, and that this may have paralyzed Kennedy in the hopes of creating a better shot for Oswald.
Okay.
Which does make sense.
That makes sense.
Now, like I said, I'm going to get more into Oswald's backstory in the next episode, but he was a Marine. So he would have been a good shot, whether it was paralyzed or not. But it does make sense that in a car, he's probably moving around waving to the people around him. He's not a steady target. So it makes sense to get him to be still, if it's possible. Now, some also believe that the umbrella may have been used as a signal for Oswald or other conspirators that the plan was in motion and that this was an opportune moment to shoot.
Was this umbrella guy ever identified?
Yes. So, okay. Well, he has stepped forward, so obviously he could be lying. Mm-hmm. But the man known as the Umbrella Man did eventually come forward. In 1978, Louis Stephen Witt testified that he was the Umbrella Man, and that the umbrella was being used as a symbol of protest against the Kennedys.
Okay.
Which, I did read a little bit about why he chose that symbol. It does make some logical sense. It was more in protest to Kennedy's father.
Mm-hmm.
Because Witt did not like some of the international affairs that Kennedy's father was taking part in. So he did have a reason for that being the symbol. But of course, he also might not be the person and just be someone that came forward with it. Because if you also think about it, the Umbrella Man theory was popular before 1978 when he came forward. So why would he have waited until 1978 instead of immediately going to the police as soon as he heard about this theory so he can clear everything up?
Wait, also side note with the tranquilizer thing, wouldn't you kind of notice that?
Well,
on camera?
You would probably be able to see, like, if it was some big dart or whatever, but it's not like, because when you imagine, when I say tranquilizer, you think of, like, a horse tranquilizer, like an animal tranquilizer, so that's, like, a big dart coming at you. So, yeah, you would kind of see that kind of thing, but the weapons that were available at this time mostly to America and the USSR, because technologically that was who had that kind of capabilities at that time, it would have been covert enough that you would not have noticed it. And also, if you think about the film that you had available to record things.
True, it was only grainy.
Yeah, you don't have a cell phone that you could have come out and recorded everything. So as long as it's small enough that it's not going to get picked up, like, there's no HD footage for them to be able to get on it. So it would have been possible that you would not have been able to catch it on film. Now, some do believe that there's too many inconsistencies in Witt's story. So there are experts that do not believe that Witt is the Umbrella Man at all. And that he is either coming forward as a cover-up for someone else, which is possible because he has ties to people that did not like Kennedy in the first place. So he would be someone that might be approached to be a cover-up. So people do question the authenticity of Witt's claims. Okay, so this is where we're going to end it for this week's episode. Part 2 has all my favorite conspiracy theories.
It's the fun stuff.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to be talking about the possibility of the government itself being responsible.
That's what I believe, so.
I think there's a lot of validity to that theory. So that's when we're going to be talking about. We're talking about the possible connections to organized crime being involved. Possibly the USSR. Possibly Cuba. So there's so many different theories. And those are the four main ones that we're going to be speaking about. But we will be speaking about as many as we can, realistically.
In the time span.
Yes. So definitely, definitely check out for part 2.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed. Tune in every Friday for more mystery and madness.
Bye, queens.